2016, the year everyone seemed to be cursing on its way out, was actually a pretty good year for me. It's the year my son was born. So I spent about half of it probably trying to take photographs of a baby. We'd be making faces at each other and laughing, and I'd think, I want to hang on to this forever. This is the moment. So I'd grab my phone and quickly take the photo, but then the angle would be totally wrong, or he'd get distracted by me and what I was doing, or my finger would be in the way, and suddenly, instead of capturing this tiny human in this beautiful moment, I'd basically just interrupt a really fun time we were having. So the iPhone clearly is not my medium, but there's something about the human condition that makes us want to stop time and capture the essence of the person right across from us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll talk to some of Kansas City's best portrait makers, from a sculptor who depicts his fellow man in bronze, to a photographer, to a textile artist. Her portraits are dolls. Let's start with the photographer, Paul Anders. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So what is it that makes people your preferred subject rather than, say, buildings or landscapes?
Portraits are just sort of instantly relatable. You can look at them and you can kind of, there's just something about them that you're able to interact with on some level where, you know, maybe different types of modern art, if you don't have a background in that sort of a thing, it can be a little bit more difficult to engage with. But portraits, you look at, you can get something from it, regardless of, you know, what kind of background you have in art or photography or whatever.
Did wanting to create portraits of other people make you pick up a camera, or was it the other way around? You were interested in the camera, you were fascinated by this tool and what you could do with it, and this relatability issue.
It was definitely the other way around for me. I started off not really photographing people at all. A lot of photographers, I think, when they start out, people are difficult because you have to approach them and talk with them and interact with them, and it can be.
And they move.
Yeah, they move and they talk back in a way that, like, you know, peeling paint on an old wall doesn't.
Huh. I never really thought about it that way. So, I mean, talk to me about those challenges. How do you overcome, like, kind of go through the ones you just laid out for me?
Well, I've taught photography for a number of years now, too, and it's something that I see my students struggle with a lot. Photography, a lot of the different creative fields, you know, the creative types tend to sometimes be a little quieter and not the most loud, boisterous of people. And so getting started in photography is kind of an internal thing, I think. So it can be difficult to then go out and have to take pictures of people. You'll go through your friends and your family pretty quickly photographing people. So one of the assignments I would give to students sometimes is to have to go photograph portraits of strangers, like approaching strangers and interacting with them and talking with them, because it's really difficult to be a photographer and be a wallflower. You have to kind of get out and interact with people and talk to people and get to know them.
There are photographers who have sort of secretly taken portraits of people, like out on the sidewalk. That's controversial.
That's an entirely different kind of photography. There's something called street photography, which is kind of the off the hip, you know, getting pictures of people doing their thing without interacting with them. It's more of a journalistic kind of approach. It's not really the kind of photography that I necessarily do. I think it can be a little bit more difficult because you're interacting with people in a different way that you are when you're actually making a portrait of somebody.
So not all photographs of people are portraits.
You could have a whole show about that. I don't know. I wouldn't agree with that entirely. A picture of somebody kind of unaware of the camera doing their thing can be a really captivating portrait of somebody. There's so many different kinds and styles of portraiture that, you know, they can all be portraiture.
What do you think it is that makes something a portrait and not just a photograph that happens to have a person in it?
That's a pretty good question.
Like, is there something that a portrait is trying to do?
I would say so, yeah. It's trying to communicate something about your subject, the person. And it can be something that they are collaborating with you on. It can be something that you are sort of, you know, putting on that person. So the kind of photography that I tend to like to do is a little bit more of a collaboration between myself and the person that I'm photographing. There's a certain amount of pre-planning or, you know, preconceptions that you have going in, but you have to leave room for improvisation and, you know, intuition about who you're photographing and what they are about, what they're like.
Do you have Like, I mean, I think picking a favorite photograph you've done would probably, I guess, be difficult. But an example of one that you were, is there one where just you saw it and you were like, that is exactly, maybe not even just what you were trying to do, more than you could have imagined you were
going to do? The ones that tend to be the more simple ones, where it's just a person in the studio. A lot of the things that I photograph are what we call environmental portraiture, which is a person in their place doing their thing. So if they have a workshop or a studio, and those can be really great because there's a really, you know, easy storytelling element to it. You can tell that this person is a pie maker or, you know, a sculptor or whatever.
You do a lot of those for us for our portrait sessions.
Yeah, I sure do. Yeah. And they're great. And I love that kind of stuff. But sometimes the more simple ones where it's just somebody in the studio looking at the camera and, you know, in my mind, not necessarily smiling like you would for a picture you would put on the fridge or frame on the wall, but it's just the person as they are. And so sometimes those can be very telling in sort of very subtle ways.
You take a lot of different kinds of portraits, as you've kind of mentioned, and they are all photographs, but I mean, like, a portrait of a bride on her wedding day is going to be very different from a portrait of a musician for an album cover or just a person who had some free time and the two of you decided to sit across from each other. At least I'm guessing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it really kind of depends on what you're trying to do or say with, you know, a portrait of somebody, where if it's, say, on a photographing a bride on her wedding day, those can be really important because that's documenting this time and this place and this person as they are on that day. Which is going to be a very different portrait of them if you were photographing them, say, part of their career or what they do. So I don't know. They're different intentions behind them.
You had a project a couple of years back where you photographed a different person every day. It was a 365 portraits. Is there something that doing portraiture that rigorously taught you about either sort of on some big philosophical level or just on this really basic practical level that just stood out as this dominant thing that emerged?
Well, I got a lot of things out of that project, and I'd recommend it to anybody who is trying to get better at anything. Just do it every day and do it a lot. So the things that were my big takeaways from that project were, you know, being able to generate work under any circumstances. So on the days when you don't want to do it and you're not in the mood for it, being able to put something together and deliver anyways. So you'll find yourself in other situations where you're not in the mood, you're not ready, you don't have the right tools, you don't have the right equipment, but you have to do it anyways. And being able to do all that and balance all that technical equipment and information, and then still be able to actually interact with the person that you're photographing and talk to them and figure out how they're going to come through in this project and not just how to see past all of the technical things to the crux of taking a portrait of somebody.
We're friends in real life and on Facebook, both. But on Facebook today, I think you posted a slideshow of your past year in photographs, and some of them appear to be photos taken on a safari.
We were really fortunate last year. We got to take a trip to Africa with a musician, Robin Hitchcock, and a small group of people. And so we got to travel and go on safari and look at all the African animals. And
some of these animal photographs also look to me like portraits. And I think that's kind of interesting. Like, there's an elephant who has this sort of ambiguous, I would say, expression on his or her face. And then there's like two leopards. I think they're leopards.
Mm.
It's a spotted cat.
They're cheetahs,
of some sort.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I'm not really an expert in that. But there's one who looks kind of like pre-pounce a little bit angle.
It was really amazing. We actually got to watch two cheetahs take down and eat some sort of hoofed little creature. I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was really amazing to watch. I mean, we were near Kruger National Park in South Africa, and this wasn't like a staged thing or anything. We watched these cheetahs for a while. It didn't really look like they were going to do anything, and then right as we left, then they took down an animal and ate it, and it was pretty gruesome, and it was pretty interesting to see
What do you think you captured about those
animals? That I don't know. I was just photographing like mad because it's not something you come across every day living in the Midwest, watching, you know, unabashed nature happen right in front of you like that. But I mean, I would say like the things like elephants and rhinoceros. I approach things the way a portrait photographer does. So when I photograph animals or pets or anything, I kind of tend to – I photograph people and in ways that we relate to them like that. So when you see a face on something, you want to pose it or shoot it or capture it some way that you would with anything – like you would with anything else.
I want to hear more from you, but let's hear from an artist who does a very different kind of portraiture. Taylor Triano is a textile artist. And Taylor, can you describe the objects you create?
The objects I create are what I would like to call plush portraits. That's what I've been calling them because the word doll, I think it's cute and a million different – I mean, you can – there's a million different kinds of dolls. But a plush portrait really is – kind of my take on a portrait. It's just stuffed.
Okay, so walk me through your process and just the most basic, like, step-by-step thing, because I think people are fairly familiar with what a photographer does with a camera, mm-hmm. but if I were to sit down and make a plushed portrait, I would not know what to do.
Right. I know. It's so I start with just a flat piece of fabric, and I adhere some interfacing to it to give it a little bit of stabilization for my sewing.
Wait. What is interfacing?
Okay, so it's you iron on a piece of – it's basically a stabilizer for the fabric just so that it's not moving around.
Okay.
So now you have like this stiffer piece of fabric. And then I'll sketch a light pencil sketch of my face. And then I decide to make it even harder on myself and go over that with a sewing machine, like freehand sewing machine. So you I stitch over the lines and then I incorporate watercolor to add dimension and give it life and color. And slowly by slowly, this thing becomes a face.
When I think about, okay, if you're looking at just a very basic stuffed, I mean, doll.
Yeah.
that is not a portrait. Just the, you know, if you think about like Charlie Brown, his face is like two dots and a squiggle.
Right.
And how do you get from something like that, that's sort of generic boy on some level, mm-hmm. to working with these same kinds of tools, specific person, like a very specific human being? You recently did a portrait of Sly James.
I did.
It looks like him.
Good. Thank you. That's funny because it's actually how I started out. I was just – when I was – these things were becoming – a thing that I was doing, it was just a little squiggle, two eyes and a squiggle. And they were supposed to be cartoons and, you know, just silly little things. And over time, I just wanted to challenge myself. And I thought, oh, well, what if I try to make this look like, you know, my friend so-and-so? And then it started to just organically go in the direction of like, really, now I'm really trying to make this look like just like the person.
So what is the hardest? Is it going to vary from person to person, or is there a feature that is consistently the hardest aspect of a human likeness to get using your tools of fabric and needle and thread?
I think the eyes, because there's so many lines and, I mean, one wrong stitch and the whole thing can just not look like the person. It's really, really stressful sometimes.
How long does one plush portrait take?
I've never sat down and done it from start to finish because right. there's so much drying time and all that. But I think I average myself 40 hours. I think that's between, you know, glue and clay and paint.
It's pretty impressive how many different materials you end up using in one of these things. Mm-hmm. And then 40 hours, I mean, dolls, as you were saying before, people think of them as toys probably. Mm-hmm. And so the association is with something maybe not super serious. And there is something, I think, kind of essentially playful about a plush portrait on some level. But you clearly take it at least somewhat seriously. And I think the people who commission these from you must take them somewhat seriously too. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's been a constant struggle, I think, trying to... equate my artwork's worth versus like something, a giant painting you would hang over your mantle. Like it comes off as amateur or silly or not like a serious work of art, but it is. It's just the same. It takes me just as much time or longer. It's a very tedious process. And, you know, at the end of the day, these are like things that you'll have forever on your wall if you don't let your dog get it.
What is it about capturing like the human portrait in doll form that interests you? I mean, it seems like partly the challenge is what interests you.
I think this stems from a long bad habit of staring. I've always just had a horrible staring problem. I love
staring at people.
For me, there's just, I can gather so much more information from watching someone that, you know, rather than the first 5 minutes of our conversation. I don't know.
That's super interesting because in some ways I do interview portraits and I'm also a writer, and people are my favorite subjects too. And I would say I have an eavesdropping problem. Sorry, anyone who I've sat next to at a restaurant.
Yeah, same thing. Like, it's just so interesting to watch people, and like their little quirky mannerisms are just, you know, how I don't all that.
And then you just found the right tools that kind of kept you interested.
Yeah, I mean, the combination of I naturally loved sewing at an early age, and I also loved drawing, and the two kind of organically came together in my later years of college, and it's just become this thing that's grown into its where it is now. I don't know.
You call your portraits Little Bits?
Yeah.
What is that name?
It was a nickname that I was given a long time ago. When I was younger, and then I started doing these dolls, and I was like, well, they're little dolls, and I don't know, it was kind of my nickname, so it just became Little Bits.
So people commission these. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of this? It's a business, and have you ever considered just making these of people who interest you visually or something, or has it always been that the commission comes first?
No, the commissions came after. I started out making tons of these and just, you know, whoever, just making up characters or doing, you know, random people. I think I did like a country series. Well, I know I did a country series.
A country series?
I did like, you know, all the old country stars like Dolly Parton and Hank Williams and all that. But I used to do art fairs and have shows at galleries, but I found that over time, people were drawn only to the dolls that they had an emotional connection to. And so after it was all said and done, I would have a pile of dolls in my house that nobody cared about. So I thought, you know what, I'll just wait until somebody approaches me with somebody that they want to have, because there's a nostalgia to the dolls, and there's an emotional connection that people have. And
what is your sense, though, of why someone comes to you and says, I would like a doll of my coworker, or I would like a doll of my relative?
I've thought about that a lot. Like, what is that versus a painting? And I think it's just, there's something, I don't know, the amount of joy this stuffed thing brings people is, I don't know, you could get really... You could talk about like, oh, I don't know.
There's a surprise element too.
There's a surprise element. And I don't know, it's nostalgic in a way that's different from a painting.
What is the difference when you talked about, you know, doing Hank Williams and Dolly Parton, and now that you've shifted to commissions, I would think that they're going to be mostly not famous people.
Some are, some aren't. I've done ones of people's famous or people's favorite musician artists, and I've also done dolls of people's past relatives, like, which is very cool.
Is your process different depending on whether this is like a regular person versus a famous person of some kind?
Only in terms of how I get access to the photos that I have to stare at forever. You know, on
so there's like a research process.
Yes. Yeah. So if it's a famous person, I obviously can find a ton of information on the internet. And if it's somebody that I don't know and it's a relative, I'll ask whoever commissioned it, like if they can just email me all kinds of pictures, or if they have a Facebook or something I can find. It just becomes a stalking process, essentially.
Paul, talk about your research process.
Well, again, it comes back to what the intention is behind the portrait. It's a lot of the portraits that I've done are people that I've known for a really long time, and sometimes it's people who I'm just meeting for the first time then. So, for example, when I'm shooting images for the portrait series that we do, most of the time it's somebody that I've never met before and I'm just meeting them that day. So it's almost a little bit easier to kind of sum up that person that you don't know as well in one picture because you know them as a butcher or a pie maker or what have you.
Or based on what your eyes are actually taking in.
Yeah, absolutely. Versus, say, somebody who I've known for a really long time, because then it becomes more difficult to encompass all of the things that you know about that person into one shot, because they might be a pie maker, but they could also be a musician and an actor and, you know, a volleyball player or whatever, you know. So it gets tougher to sort of encompass them into one thing.
Do you think that that is why I try so many times over and over to take a photograph of my baby? And you have so many photographs of your wife. I mean, I think about that.
I have very few of my wife, actually. She actually hates having her picture taken.
Well, it's interesting, though. I mean, can you talk about someone who you know so well that you actually have trouble photographing them? Would that be her? Or?
Yeah, for sure. That's the case with her. And you know what? Back the portrait project that you mentioned, where I did a new one every day, some of the people were, you know, something that I had done for, say, a magazine or something along those lines. And then sometimes you're photographing a friend of yours, and it can be a lot more difficult to just kind of put all that together.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a bronze sculptor who's been commissioned to do weighty, monumental-type portraits, including a controversial one of Rush Limbaugh, and a curator who can put these artists' work in the context of art history. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're making portraits of portrait makers. What inspires artists in all different mediums to attempt to capture something essential about specific human beings? They use anything from some fabric and a needle and thread to a camera, which may seem like an obvious tool, but the skill is not quite as democratic as the technology. I am proof of that. Now let's meet an artist whose medium is definitely not something we've all used. E. Spencer Schubert makes sculptures out of bronze. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
How did you start making bronze sculptures?
You know, I went to the University of Kansas, and I have a degree in sculpture, and I just fell into it, just from one thing to the next. I started in silversmithing, and I switched. And much like Taylor was talking about, it was the challenge. You know, the human face is like the most complex, most interesting, most changing thing that we see. And at first, it really was, I can't do this, and I want to be able to do this because it's hard. And that's how I got started.
So it started as being something that was a challenge, but obviously you got good at it. Can you describe what that process was like for you?
Yeah, the process of getting good at making clay look like people is a lot like sitting in your basement and beating your head against the wall. I mean, truly, you know, people ask that question a lot. And what I tell them is that it's seriously just hard work. I mean, you know, of course, at the beginning I was interested and I wanted to keep doing it. But after that, it was just hours and hours, you know, coupled with the honesty with myself that that's not good.
What makes something not good? I mean, is accuracy the issue?
Well, the unfortunate reality is that everything's relative. So, you know, good back then is different than good today. And I think that, you know, I think Taylor can relate to this a lot, too, is that capturing a person in static form, you know, a lot of times it's closer to caricature than true anatomical reality. Right?
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you're seeing people all day, every day, they're moving around and they have specific expressions and they have things that they do that you don't really notice in the context of talking with them. But then when you try to, you know, solidify that and capture it, just trying to be respectful of the way their chin relates to their eye and their nose and then the geometry of their face. If you do that, it's boring and it seems less accurate than real life, right? I mean, I can make, you know, these days especially, you can make a 3D scan of a person's face and then look at that scan and be like, well, that doesn't, I mean, I see how that is that person, but it doesn't really look like that person. And so I think the distinction between, and I think a lot of people get close to that caricature first in their skill, and then, at least for me, approach the anatomy reality later. Because I think...
What is the caricature about, though, if it's not about anatomical reality?
Well, it's specific to the person every single time, and it's something that's constantly surprising to me. Because at this point, I'm good enough to know what the face is doing. And I have reference material that is good enough to verify whether or not I'm being honest. And quite often, when I'm making a portrait of someone, I have to violate what I know to be true to respect the person that I am trying to represent.
Okay, I'm going to need you to give me an example.
Okay, well, so, let's see. What's a recent example? So I just finished a portrait of George R. Smith, the founder of Sedalia, Missouri, for the high school. And so it is a gentleman who's, you know, Civil War era general. There's two photographs of him, but only one that's really usable. And so in that specific instance, if I had really made his facial hair as kind of out of control and awesome as it was, it just wouldn't have felt real. So I had to tone that down, and it still really looks, you know, it looks like your perception of the portrait. And that's an easy example, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, the Heinlein portrait for the Missouri State Capitol, his mouth is so wide in the portrait that they wanted me to model in the smile that I just had to pull it back a little bit so that it felt real.
So, something that's interesting to me, because I think of monumental bronze sculpture as being kind of larger than life in a way.
Right.
And you're talking about scaling back the larger than life attributes that people actually have in order to make that not seem that way.
Well, it depends. And I think everything, you know, again, is relative. If we're talking about a monument that's going to be 15 feet off the ground, then really the only thing that matters is that I capture the big volumes. Because you're not going to be able to have an intimate relationship with that portrait. Now, the, you know, a portrait bust that you can walk up to, like in the state capitol, in the Missouri State Capitol, there's 44, 45 different portrait busts you can walk right up to and stare them in the face. And that's a totally different relationship with a piece of sculpture than outside on an 8-foot tall plinth and 15 feet tall on top of that.
Okay, I already regret asking this, and I haven't even done it yet, but you were talking about things faces do that make the just anatomical reality not quite true. What are some things that my face does that you would think would be hard to capture?
Well,
I regretted it before I said it because this could be harsh.
This isn't me not answering the question. I would have to spend, you know, hours staring at photos of you, and preferably, if I get the opportunity, spending time in a room with you or watching video of you, because really, portraiture is about not representing what somebody's body looks like. It's about representing who somebody is. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, like any skill, as the further you get into it, the more you realize that it's a broader topic than you thought. So at first I just thought, if I can make a face look like a face, then I'll know how to make a face look like a face. Right. And now I realize that making a face look like a face quite often is failure. Because
do you have something that you felt was a failure because it was too closely hewn to the just facial structure? And
I did a portrait of me. I did a self-portrait. It's the one that I've done, and it's in my studio. And I am a nice guy, and I smile a lot, I think, right? And the portrait that I did is super severe. And I don't know why, you know.
So it looks like you, but a mean guy?
Yeah, it looks like me if you didn't want to see me in a dark alley. But, like, I'm cool to see in a dark alley. I can be like, hey, how's it going? you know, that's off the top of my head. I mean, there's, you know.
I want to talk to our other guests about this because that's interesting to me that, I mean, part of what I feel like you're talking about, too, is that a portrait captures, unless it's video, captures a moment. And you interact with people in more than one moment. People are kind of in motion. And, yeah, Taylor, what are your thoughts on what we've been hearing Spencer saying?
I agree with so much of it. It's What was the question?
Well, just as far as especially this whole idea that the accuracy of the features might not create a portrait that looks like that really captures anything about that person.
Right. No, yeah, that's exactly right. He put it so well. It's especially when when I start out, my subject is flat, and then I at the end of it, it's totally curved and round and puffed out, and so that in it of itself skews now my original flat portrait.
Because you're making a doll that starts as working flat on a piece of fabric.
Right. So sometimes I have to account for the fact that it's going to bubble out and get round. And, you know, sometimes it changes the whole look of it. And sometimes I'm like, dang, I really like the way it was before. But
have you ever thought about doing flat fabric portraits?
I have. And who knows? Maybe someday.
Paul, what about you? I mean, you've talked about spending time with people. What are you doing during that time? Is it the same thing Spencer is doing?
Well, what I'll add to that is a lot of what I do when I make a portrait of somebody is post-processing. And that can be a big, big, big part of making a portrait of somebody. And sometimes you end up doing a lot of post-processing, sometimes none at all. But, you know, when people come in for like a business headshot, you know, the comment that I get all the time is like, oh, make sure you use the young filter or the wrinkle filter, you know, in Photoshop to remove all the lines and smile lines and whatnot. And you know, sometimes when you make a portrait of somebody in the studio, to point a 21 megapixel camera at somebody and then blow it up to 100% on a screen can be a little scary sometimes. So a little bit of softening and, you know, removing wrinkles and taking some circles from someone's eyes. It doesn't seem disingenuous to me, because sometimes, you know, the 100% accuracy, you know, of somebody's face, just like with the sculpture, it makes they'll look too tired or too severe or something. And so using the tools that I have, which are, you know, Photoshop and things like that, to bring the portrait of them more into the idea of your or their idea of what they look like. Can actually be more accurate than just a cold representation of what they are.
So in my medium, it's kind of the opposite. Like I want to see, like I want those wrinkles. And like the older the subject, the more fun it is for me, because it's just
sometimes you absolutely
there's
do.
So much more to work with. But at the same time, I've had, you know, somebody ask me to do a doll of their 98-year-old grandmother, and they're like, we know she's 98, but can you make her look beautiful still, you know, pretty still? And so you have to find that balance. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think Taylor is right. And when you were talking about the flat portrait, right, that's a perfect example of it's not real, right? She's capturing the things about a face that we all recognize as that face, completely different in three dimensions than it actually is, right? So I really feel like respecting the ness, you know, to put it in quotes, the ness of the person is really important.
I want to jump in, because as long as we're talking about kind of the distinction between, just the role of maybe idealization in some of this. I mean, you were sort of, you had a moment in the media spotlight when you were commissioned to do a portrait, a bronze sculpture, a monumental bronze sculpture of Rush Limbaugh. And the question of whether doing a portrait is a way of endorsing a person more broadly, especially a famous person, especially a famous politician. That's an interesting question. And how you answer these little questions along the way, like, do I make this person look quote-unquote better or something, that becomes significant in a different way in that context.
Absolutely. And I think, so I take very seriously my role in documenting, say, the conversation. You know, when I did the Rush Limbaugh portrait, I released a statement after the big kerfuffle, which was, by the way, totally insane, and no wonder famous people are crazy.
Yeah, and I can't wait for you to tell that story, but please go on with where you are.
Yeah, I can't even. What was I saying? Totally lost it. I think that the role in the conversation is important, right? And so whether or not you're documenting somebody's grandmother, that it's a personal documentation of that, you know, that small little relationship, or whether or not you're documenting the fact that we are where we are politically in this world, and you know, the Hall of Famous Missourians honorees are chosen by the Speaker of the Missouri House of Representatives, and we happen to have a Republican state legislature, and the Speaker is Republican, and he chooses people who that group of people think are important. So I think in doing that, I'm respecting the conversation, not in, I mean, you know.
Well, tell me the story of how you came to be creating a sculpture of Rush Limbaugh and how you saw that project.
Okay, so I create a lot, not all, of the portraits for the Missouri State Capitol, the Hall of Famous Missourians. And the Hall of Famous Missourians is the space between the House and Senate chambers. And there are, you know, 40, 45 busts starting in the 80s up until now of famous Missourians. And historically, the Speaker of the Missouri House of Representatives has chosen who those people are. And so that year, I think that was 2012, they called and asked if I would sculpt Buck O'Neill, you know, Mr. Kansas City, and Dred Scott. And so I was about halfway through both of those busts. And then they called
Dred
back.
Dred Scott, who?
Right. Civil rights icon. Right. You know, he sued for his freedom, because of kind of the nuances of how he had been transported from slave state to non-slave state. And the Supreme Court at that time, in its infinite, in quotes, wisdom, said that, well, sorry, you can't even bring the suit because you're not actually a person, right? So obviously deserves a place in the Hall of Famous Missourians. And that was a great project to work on. And so when I was in the process of doing those, they called and said, oh, by the way, we want you to do a third one. And I was like, awesome. And they said, and it's Rush Limbaugh. And I was like, okay. You know, I know this is going to be crazy. But I'm a sculptor.
The only because thing, was it more crazy because of his still being alive and still being controversial?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have opinions about who should be memorialized in bronze. And I think typically, you know, I wouldn't tell a client this, but we should just wait until after people are deceased, because people are alive and doing things one way or the other. And I think, you know, the Penn State situation was a very good example of that. And so it was just crazy because I knew from the get-go that it was going to be an issue, but I'm a sculptor. I make sculptures.
Well, when we get back, we're going to get back to this conversation about portrait making, everything from that photograph you take of yourself or your friend to a monumental bronze sculpture of Rush Limbaugh. We're going to hear what an art historian has to say about all of this. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've been talking with artists Paul Andrews, Taylor Triano, and Spencer Schubert, a photographer, a doll maker, and a sculptor who works in bronze. We've been discussing the intricacies of portraiture and the motivations for portraiture, the interpretations of portraiture, whether having a bronze sculpture of someone means that they are being dignified and agreed with, or if it just means that they have a significant role in our society and a sculptor is interested in their face. We've also got a curator in the studio. Amy Marcereau Degalen is with us from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Hi again, Amy.
Good morning.
So tell me what you're hearing. I mean, are these some of the themes that as you look into, you specialize in European art, when you look into European art history and portraiture in specific, are these the questions that people have always been asking?
Exactly. I think so many of these artists have touched on the reasons that I went into the study of portraiture. But I think at the end of the day, portraiture really reflects a mediation between the artist and the sitter. And it's rarely, if ever, indexical to the real. And there's so many layers that are going on that provide windows into a time and a moment and a place that, for me, make art of the past come alive.
So looking at what one artist saw in one other person tells you more about a time and place than looking at maybe like statistics of how humans lived at that time?
I think it's all part of a fabric that can be woven together to tell about a time and a place. And I think it's sort of a mystery in some ways. What are the clues that an artist is giving you to learn more about that person? And I think Paul at the beginning said something about, you know, he takes these portraits of these individuals, sometimes in their place, and so you know that they're a pie maker or something else. Artists are doing the same thing, and it's, again, this dialogue that exists between the sitter and the portrait maker that tell this story. And, you know, we can learn things about people that we knew about, but it's often a lot of fun to find out and determine clues about unidentified sitters and what are the clues that the artist has given you or that the person has given you to provide a window into that person's soul.
Can you give me an example? Tell me maybe the story of a specific work of art and what you saw in it, and then how that perception maybe changed as you learned more about the sitter or the artist or their relationship?
Oh, gosh. There was an unidentified portrait at a previous museum that I worked at, and it just, there was something about it. It was this woman, it was a half-length portrait, so it basically cut from her waist up above. And we knew who the artist was, who was a well-known artist at the time, so we, you know, right out of the gates, you knew that whoever the sitter was, they must have had enough money to afford that, to commission that artist. And then you look a little bit deeper and you see she is wearing a certain kind of lace collar. Well, where is that lace collar? Where is that lace available? She was a certain member of society who could have afforded that type of specific lace from Flanders. And you just go from there. And I think it's why so many art historians love mystery novels, because you go from one clue to the next. Similarly, you know, reading a portrait like that, that's one avenue. But then if you don't know the artist, there are other avenues through the advance of technology that I think really do provide wonderful clues that help identify an artist, such as pigment analysis or looking at the weave of a canvas. I mean, these are things that are just, with every passing year, we're able to learn more and more with this marriage of chemistry and conservation science and art history.
What about this question of commissions? We've heard that a number of the artists working today who create portraits do that, whether they're commissioned by the person who the portrait is of or someone who loves them or for the Hall of Famous Missourians. What does that tell you? What is the significance of that if you're looking back in art history across time and in different civilizations?
That's a great question, and it plays such an important role in how I look at portraits, whether they're commissioned, who commissioned them. Often, the other element to consider is whether the artist was trying to sell the portrait as well. I mean, that's a whole other layer of that influences sort of how you look at a portrait, at least how many of us probably look at portraits. There's a great example of a full-length portrait at the Nelson painted by John Hoppner of his mistress. It's it's a massive painting, and he painted her as you would paint a mistress. I mean, it's this lush portrait, and she's very sensual, and it wasn't the style that the artist normally would paint in. He painted a little bit tighter, if you look at his portraits across time, but it was a commission, and so obviously he wanted to get paid. It was a dialogue, again, between the artist and the person who commissioned it, and you have this resulting full-length, very sensuous portrait. And it's not surprising to know what her role was in his life. But at the end of that story, unfortunately, he got married and the portrait was rolled up and went by a different name and cast aside for many, many years. And I think these portraits provide, they're social documents. And I think that they, you know, I love what everybody was saying before about accuracy and likeness, and creating portraits isn't necessarily creating every nook and cranny. It's a great phrase that artists said at the time. Portraits are good, but not like. It's the likeness. It's that. It's catching. It's something in an interior part of their soul that really makes a portrait, I think, sing.
What about this story about Spencer? I mean, Spencer found himself in the middle of a really like public media controversy for creating, based on commission, a sculpture of Rush Limbaugh. And Spencer, can you describe a little bit of what that, you called it a kerfuffle, just very briefly, was like?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was sitting there sculpting and the CNN news desk editor called and said, "We want you to go live on the air." I'm like, "Yeah, click, I'm not going to be talking to you."
But why not?
Why wouldn't I talk to him? Well, because my role in that situation was to make the best portrait, and that was a distraction. I've never really been interested in, I want to make sculptures. I don't want to have made sculptures, right? I'm not interested in that part. And so the only thing I really learned from that situation is that extremism, no matter what side it is on, is an annoying and terribly unfortunate thing.
Because, well, and you're trying to capture something human, and it sounds like in some ways it's dehumanizing.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to make the best look. I was the right person to make that sculpture because I think about where this thing sits in our culture. And I tried to make a portrait that both sides would look at and see the way they saw the man.
They would see their own seeing.
Right. You know, I mean, one person's going to look at that and see it the way they want to see it, and the other person's going to look at it and see it the way they want to see it.
Amy, I mean, is this also the story of artists and commissions of portraits, that accepting a commission can be an entry into the public eye of a kind?
Exactly. I think there are so many great examples of that. I mean, I think about Goya, who had to paint many of the monarchy, and he hated that, the whole thing. And so you look at those portraits, and they're not very flattering portraits, but he had to do a job, and he did it well, and he represented them. And I think it's...
How did not being flattering go over for Goya?
Well, I mean, he retained his position as court painter, but I think that, again, it goes back to this dialogue, and I think representing something good or something like, and capturing part of that person's inner essence, which is what we're talking about.
And I think it's important to understand that what one person might see as flattering is what another person might see as not flattering. I mean, it really depends on, you know, those portraits that aren't flattering, they might have said, oh, look how regal I look.
You know, I want to touch also on technology, because right now when you think about portraiture, the selfie that is all over social media, or Spencer has mentioned 3D sculpture or 3D printing, which might seem to make the really specialized technique and artistry that all of you are doing a little more democratic, but maybe a little, in a way, less valued. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, so portraiture, you know, pre-photography was really the territory of the very rich. And so the only people that you have portraits of are important, influential, and wealthy people. With the invention of photography, it kind of brought it to a more everyday thing. Now, in the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, you might have only had one portrait taken of you your entire life. But as time has gone on, you know, we know everyone has cameras now. So I don't even think they make phones that don't have cameras in them anymore. So everybody is taking pictures of themselves all the time. And so I don't know if it values or devalues portraits in general, but it makes it something that all of us are more accessible to and more able to interact with.
What about the 3D printing?
Well, it's funny. Paul's industry or art form has gone through this before. You know, I sometimes feel as a sculptor like a portrait painter must have felt at the advent of photography, because up until that point, they had a monopoly on the portrait. And now, I mean, you can buy a 3D scanner. You can scan somebody's face. So it's a really interesting time. But like, you know, it's important. Interpretation is important.
What separates portraiture as an art from plain old vanity or even just sentimentality?
Again, the ness of the subject and the conversation and the capturing of that moment in time in a very, I mean, it's hard to define, but intention matters.
You know, Amy, I wonder if you think that we're in a time of unprecedented access to the tools of portraiture, or does every time feel like that? Because as we said, kind of starting the show, this feels like kind of a universal human impulse.
I think that the latter. I think that since the beginning of time, people wanted representations of their loved ones or important people and found a way to do it. I mean, you look at the earliest cave paintings and all the way forward and early forms of portrait miniatures, that people want to find and feel that connection to the human form, and they'll find whatever means they can to do it.
The technology that was available to me in the sewing machine world, I bought a very expensive sewing machine a long time ago, thinking I would expedite my process and like it would do it for you, sew it for you. But it turns out it just, you lose the hand and you lose the feel. And so I ditched that and went back to my...
So sometimes the technology that we think is opening up access is actually...
Yeah, just kind of sterilizing it.
Taylor Triano, textile artist of Little Bits Dolls, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Amy Marcero Degelin, Lewis L. and Adelaide C. Ward, Senior Curator of European Arts, quite a title, at the Nelson. Thank you.
Thank you.
E. Spencer Schubert, bronze sculptor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a bunch.
And Paul Andrews, photographer, it's been great.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, guys. Well, tomorrow we'll be back at the same time with a show about the movie Hidden Figures, which tells the true story of the African-American women whose math skills were a secret force in NASA's space race back in the era of segregation. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stick around.